Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison, former NFL player, now climbing the seven summits, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Okay, look, 7-8 years ago, I had to step into the fear and put a big-ass goal out there, and so I decided to start climbing all these crazy mountains around the world. It's been an absolute amazing journey. And, you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I've actually done 6 of the 7. I've actually been on Denali twice. I've been on climb successfully Kilimanjaro twice. But now it's Mount Everest, the biggest boy on the block, 29,000 plus. And I'm headed over there April 2020. And I'm totally keyed up. And I'm keyed up because I've been doing all this preparation. I train like an absolute bear. And, really putting myself in a position of success. I'm going to be climbing with one of the top climbing outfitters in the world. Excited about that. And just the mountain has fascinated me for years, I'm sure like others, but really excited to do so. And so if I can actually pull this thing off, I'd be the first NFL player to do so. And so as we speak today, there's not that many first in the world. So I look forward to tackling that. Okay, so that's one. Two is I totally appreciate the listen on these different podcasts. I really do. And it's been an amazing journey, as I said, from not just interviewing these people, but being on the other side of the mic and really taking in their incredible stories of doing amazing things. And look, we all need to be inspired. And so if I can help provide and find more people that meet that criteria, all the better. And it just, we all need that motivation, and we all need that those words of encouragement that you can make it back relevant to your own situation and then plow forward in whatever endeavor you are trying to do. Okay, so I appreciate that. And if you want to find out anything that I have going on, you can do so at markpattisonnfl.com. I've got a book out now called Finding Your Summit, go figure. And it is essentially the playbook to what I had learned from my Hall of Fame coaches on how to emerge and do some great things in your life. It doesn't have to be mountain climbing, of course. It can be anything, but it's a plug-in that you take on these different things, these different goals, that these different strategies that I've set forth, that they set forth for me. And good things can come from that. Okay. Also on the website, you can find out more about my expedition. Obviously, I'll be going to Mount Everest, and we'll have more information about that coming up. There's an e-learning course and, of course, the podcast. And when you go to the podcast, you will find an iTunes tab. And I would be so grateful if you go in and you'd rate and review. Now, it all has to do with visibility, popularity of podcasts, because there's so many podcasts out there today that it's so easy to get lost and like, wait, where's Finding Your Summit? And I think I really do believe these stories are really amazing and incredible and can really give a lift to those people who really need it. And even if you don't, we all need to be motivated and inspired by other people to keep going. So if you'd go in and do that, I would be really, really appreciative. Okay, so let's go listen to the pod. It's going to be awesome. Here we go. Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I am so fired up because I'm back with another fantastic episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And literally when I say, sometimes I've referenced this in the past, and I've said I've got such a rock star on this weekend, and literally I have a rock star, a guy that I grew up with. He, in my opinion, he's got one of the best voices of our time, and he lives here in Ketchum, Idaho, and I was able to grab him and put him on the pod. His name is Peter Cetera. Peter,
hey,
how
please,
you doing?
Please, please, sit down, everybody. How you doing, man?
Oh man, this is such a joy and an honor to have you on the pod, and your voice. We were talking about this the other day when I ran into you at the grocery store, and actually it was at Java, and I was saying to you, is this like, what is it in your life when the first time you open up your mouth and this instrument, these notes come out in your head as these things are coming out of your mouth, they're coming out and you're saying something like, I've got something a little bit special here.
I don't know. I started out really early in the house. I was the oldest of five. My mother was a frustrated singer. She always had the radio on, and she taught us harmonies. And I started singing, and she, you know, kind of said, yeah, you're pretty good. So, you know, right from the start, I started getting that positive thing. And I think it's carried through to the years when I recorded, you know, it took me a long time. Boy, you know, when that red light goes on in the studio, it's scary. You know, it takes you a while to get over that. It took me a while, and it still did for years and years. And I think when people ask me about singing, to me it was the emotion, I think, is the thing that I tried to give to everything I sang. Emotion, feeling. And I may not be the best scat singer or, you know, whatever, but, you know, I try and sing from the heart, from the feeling, and I think that comes through to a lot of people.
Well, there's no question it does. And in my opinion, you're, and I don't want to boil this down to just like there's five or six, but I think in terms of the love songs, when you're talking about the passion, the emotion that come out, I think certainly the top five songs, you know, right up there, you know, I don't know how you can compete. But so like when I was playing back in the Little League, you know, I was typically faster than everybody. And I had some ball skills. I was coordinated more than most. And so I knew that I had skill. But as I kept going up, you know, it's like one after the other would fall off as the pyramid got a lot steeper. And then where I really had to figure out is like, if I want to be successful at this, and there's no certainty on where any of this was going to go, probably, I'm sure, like when you write a song. But I had to work on my craft. And I had to get bigger. I had to get stronger. I had to get more astute about the game of football to actually get out there and then survive in it. And so as a singer and a songwriter, is it the same type of thing where you just continue to hone your game? So even though at a young age, 11 or something or 12, when you won a talent contest, you know that for you to get to a higher place, you need to surround yourself with the right people, but you also need to take voice lessons, or how does that all work?
I don't know. It was a long process. I mean, when I was a kid, strangely enough, I wanted to be a football player or a baseball player.
And by the way, I want to be a singer.
Yeah, exactly. Most sports people, I mean, there's that connection. Yeah. And I'm not kidding. There's so many musical people who wanted to be sports, and I was one of those. I was pretty good. I wasn't the fastest, but I could catch anything, and I could, I mean, I was good that way, and I thought, I want to be a baseball player, a football player. And then little by little, I started singing and got into actually, I shouldn't say this, but I played accordion for a while.
Yeah.
My parents wouldn't buy me a guitar. And no, we're not, you know, Polish south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
And I think I might have been the last boy in Chicago to take accordion lessons. I don't know. I ended up getting a job my freshman year in high school, saved enough money to buy a little guitar. And then changed schools. I went from Quigley, which was a seminary school in downtown Chicago. I went to Mendel, which is a school on the south side of Chicago where I lived, 108th and Vincennes. And bought this chord book and started singing. And I noticed, I started playing sports, hurt my back in football, you know, before we even started. And learned enough of the top 10 songs to start singing, and noticed that when we would go to parties or go to the beach parties that we always used to have, Everybody's getting drunk. The guys are falling on their face. And I'm over there with like 10 girls around me singing.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
I figured that was pretty good.
And, you know, I was a reluctant performer, let's just say. You know, I never walked on stage with that, I'm going to slay him. You know, I always walked on stage with, oh, my God, I can't breathe. You know, really, I mean, Seriously. And it's just like sports. It takes you a couple of plays to get into the game.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Tell me about the Rebel Rockers.
The Rebel Rockets. Yeah.
Rockets.
Rebel Rockets. They were the first group I ever saw that I went, oh my gosh. It was there was a teenage nightclub on the south side of Chicago. And when I was like in right between eighth grade and high school, I worked at this supermarket, and these two older guys, older, they were like 19 or 20, took me to this rock and roll, this teenage rock and roll club. It looked like a real thing from, you know, except no booze. And this group comes on, the Rebel Rockets from Mattoon, Illinois. And both guitar players stood on top of the amps. The lead singer wore sunglasses. And it was about the coolest thing I've ever seen or heard. And that right there just went, I want to do that. I don't want to go to the seminary, Mom. But I still went for a year, and then later got into, started the group in high school. End up playing the dances all the way through senior year. Got better, started singing more. And it just kind of went on from there. Never went to college. I was thinking about it, but I didn't like school, you know. I like singing. So I went through most of my entire life thinking, I hope they never find out that I don't really know what I'm going to do when I grow up. No, that's the truth.
But it just kept going.
Yeah, it just kept going. And, you know, you get a little more confident. And, yeah.
So I think you were one of the founders of the Chicago Transit Authority.
Well, I actually joined, I would say, maybe 5-6 months after they started.
Yeah.
We were, my last gig with the band that I was in for 7 years called The Exceptions, we were the best band in Chicago. We did top 40, which is what you had to do back then.
Yeah.
Every club had a band, not like now, you know. And we were always, I was never out of a job since I've been 16, 17 years old. I was always working gigs, playing. Even when I was going to high school, I was working late gigs. And joined The Exceptions, and we, just about when that had run its course, I was the last original member. We played a gig with this group called The Big Thing. There was a club opening up in Chicago, and they hired us both to open the club the first week. And, you know, I heard these guys, and I went, yeah, they're pretty good. No bass player. That's funny. The organ.
Yeah.
Bobby was playing pedals.
Yep.
And I had had it with the group I was in, and they kind of blew us right out of the water, you know. And I was kind of dejected. And then halfway through the, you know, a couple of nights, the drummer said, hey, can we talk to you about something? I went, sure. So after the gigs, we went to breakfast, and they said, we're looking for a bass player that sings.
That was you.
That was me.
Yeah. And the rest is history, right?
Yeah. So we started out working local gigs, you know, and matter of fact, we were, you know, it was funny. We, a couple of the old things, we were playing this gig in Milwaukee, and Cream at the time.
Yeah.
And they were just so big. They were right across the street that night. And we were playing, and we were bummed because we were playing in this dive. And the owner was a real jerk. And he was getting it on with one of his waitresses, you know, on the sneak.
Yeah.
And he comes up. There's nobody in the place. It's everybody's. He comes up and he says, hey, play a belly rubber, you know. And so we purposely played a Frank Zappa song. Yeah. A slow, but of a Frank Zappa song. He goes, hey, you mother, you're fired. We went, great. We were packed up. We were packed up in about 10 minutes. Out the door, went across the street to see Cream. You know, it was, that's kind of where the enough of these clubs, you know.
So what? How old are you at this time? Because you,
I was probably
21?
20. No, I was 25,
yeah.
26,
yeah.
A little older, yeah.
So did you guys have your clear path yet? You know, I know
no.
you continue to, you know, so let me insert this. So on Netflix, there's this this great documentary on Chicago.
Oh, I call it the crockumentary.
The crockumentary?
Croc.
Oh, crockumentary.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, listen, I don't know all the insight, right?
Well,
I don't
didn't participate, so that should tell you how
I
feel about
I know. I know that. But, there's nobody on the planet that will ever say that you weren't a huge, gigantic part of that band.
Yeah.
And you've
got no doubt about it.
Yeah. I mean, you wrote the songs. I mean, yeah. So all that said, though, that whether what parts are true or not, you guys jamming yourself in a small car and traveling all over the country and playing that life for how many years before you started to have some success?
Well, it took a little while, but we all drove out from Chicago. I drove out in my 67 Volkswagen, pulling a trailer. And we all went out to L.A. We lived in the same house. 8 guys in a house, 7 of us and a road manager. And we just started working clubs. We started working the Long Beach State. We had a club there. We started working for burgers.
Yeah.
Really, we started working colleges. We played the whiskey, Whiskey A Go-Go. On an off night, he liked us enough. He hired us on Monday and Tuesday nights. And then we worked our way up to working with the headliner. We'd come on first, the headliner, and we'd go on. And then we ended up being the headliner. But I would say the first couple of years, it was tough. The first year was tough. And then after we recorded, we played every college that you can imagine driving, right? I think we just about drove across Canada same way, 261 nighters or something like that.
What's that like?
Year.
Yeah, I mean, is it because
it's a blur? It's all a blur.
A blur. And today you would say it's probably a nightmare, right?
Yeah.
But back then, when you have the energy and
it's exciting,
all this stuff,
and it's fun, and you're in a new college, and looking back on it, you blow your brains out, and then, that's what kind of made us this underground thing, and then.
So frame this up in the time, in what year was this?
69, 70.
Okay, so
it started to happen.
So one of the bands I heard that you opened up for is one of my hometown guys from Seattle, is Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
Was awesome. We were playing the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Yeah.
Actually.
In L.A.?
And we were the headlining. I mean, we worked our way up to the other people were open.
Yeah.
And so one night we're on stage, and I'm playing, and I look back in the corner, there's just a little light, and there's a guy, and I go, "Hey," to one of the other guys, "is that Jimi fucking Hendrix?" And we all looked, "Holy shit, Jimi Hendrix!" And you get all like nervous and stuff. And so we went upstairs on the break, and my God, we're like going, "Jimi Hendrix, oh my God!" And there's knock on the door, and it's our road manager, and he comes, he walks in, his eyes are bulging, he goes, "Jimi Hendrix wants to come and see you guys." So Hendrix walks in the room, and the door opens, and there he is with that black kind of flat brimmed hat and all the accoutrements.
Mr. Cool,
my God, he looked just, and he walked in and he goes, "You cats motherfuckers." Just like that. And I was like, whoa. So he came in and he sat and talked with us the whole set. And he goes, "God, you guys are so good. I mean, it's..." And sure enough, shortly after that, his manager got a hold of us. And he wants to take you as his opening act. What? Let's go. So we did. It was awesome.
And in those early days, did you have the sound refined from the standpoint of having the horns? That was one of the things that I think really separated you from so many.
Well, yeah, I mean, every song wasn't horns, but it was unique.
Yeah.
It was fairly unique. And what we were doing, everybody was always trying to compare us to Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Yeah.
And my thing is we were basically a rock band trying to play a little jazz. I'm not a jazz player, but I think Blood, Sweat, and Tears was a jazz band trying to play a little rock, and they weren't really rock players.
Yeah.
Actually, Janis Joplin, same thing happened. Janis Joplin heard us somewhere. She came before a show that she was doing somewhere. She had an off night and heard us early on. And same thing. "I'm going to take you guys on the road," So we were her opening act for a tour. And by the second or third night, she would start coming over with us because we'd go 2 hours early to school. And we were always messing around if there was a basketball, shooting the hoops and screwing around and laughing and tuning up. And she just started sitting in one of the benches in the locker room and just sitting there with her legs curled up and just, "You guys are so funny. I love this. You guys are so funny." And she was so nice. And she was, and finally, when it was time for us to go, then she would say, "Well, I guess it's time for me to become Janis Joplin." And she'd go in her purse and pull out Southern Comfort. I mean, that's, she was sober the whole time and great. And it was all part of the act. And so at the end of the tour, she says, "I hate these fuckers on stage," you know, the band that she was with. "I want you guys to be my band." And we had we thought about it for one night and we said, "Nah, we're going to go our own way." So it was pretty exciting.
By the way, good choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too.
So there's another film that's recently come out on Laurel Canyon. And back in that era when the Beach Boys were in there and Neil Young.
Sorry, what was the film?
It's on Laurel Canyon.
I haven't seen that. Yeah.
So it's just about, it's just interesting because there's a moment in time where all these music artists who later would have these amazing careers all lived in this stretch where they're all getting together and they're writing songs and all these other things. I mean, were you guys part of that?
No, never. Yeah. That was a different, we were in the Hollywood. No, we were trying to make our own way. And that was right at the time when we got out there, right? And Laurel Canyon was, oh my God, you know who lives here, blah, blah, blah. Matter of fact, you could drive up Laurel Canyon and there was Frank Zappa's house, was right on the corner.
Yeah.
This log cabin, and you could see Zap out in the yard. I mean, we were over more in Hollywood, right near the Hollywood Freeway, and actually we moved right about the same time another band from Chicago called Illinois Speed Press had a modicum of success, and they lived right next door to us.
Hmm.
So, and I think we'd always prided ourselves in the fact that every day we practiced, we'd get up, eat, start practicing. Learning songs, playing things. They were a little later in the day, so.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just knock off some of these songs. If you leave me now, which became a number one for you guys, Hard to Say I'm Sorry, You're the Inspiration, Glory of Love, Feeling Stronger Every Day. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. You know, I was trying to think about this, and I don't understand this because I'm obviously not a singer-songwriter, but whether you're a singer only or a songwriter only or a combination like yourself, like how do you come up with a song? Like you're walking around the block or you see something or a phrase, like how does something like that become a hit?
Everybody's different. I am very reluctant. I'm kind of that bad student that doesn't start studying till the night before the test. You know what I mean? So I don't have a lot of songs laying around, and I never had. So I would always stick with an idea that I thought was pretty strong. If You Leave Me Now, it just came, I mean, literally, there were the chords, about the only chords I knew on a guitar. And I was just sitting there. I was living, at the time, I was living Carbon Canyon Beach, and going up to Colorado to record. And hadn't written a lot up to that, you know, reluctantly, you know. And that's the thing, you, looking back on from Chicago One on, you see our career, you get to see, like, for instance, my career. I get to hear the songs that I was just wrote, and I wasn't, never really written before.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to hear, oh, my God, I got... kind of embarrassing, you know, you sort of see your preschool and it's right there for the rest of history. But If You Leave Me Now, it's just something I started playing. And I just thought of that phrase, If You Leave Me Now. And I started playing the chords, and it took me a while to get, but then whereas Happy Man, which is another one I
great
wrote.
Song.
Happy Man, I wrote driving on my motorcycle down the 405 to Newport Beach or something at 11:30 at night.
So you must
when
happy.
You could do that.
Yeah.
While I was going to see someone, that's, you know.
Yeah, he's very happy.
Yeah. And I wrote that song, and it was the only song that I ever did that to that I could remember, right?
Yeah.
As I'm driving down the 405 at 65, 70 miles an hour. And I went home that night and tried to find the chords that I was singing and wrote that one. It all comes in different things. It all comes in different ways. Wishing You Were Here, which is a song I had the Beach Boys sing some backgrounds on.
I got to ask you about that, but
that was the greatest. Well, when I was living on Pacific Coast Highway, living on the beach, one night I was sitting there and the waves are coming in.
This is up in Malibu?
It's in Malibu, yeah. Yeah, I lived after we moved around from Hollywood, three or four places, I bought this place. Or I didn't buy. I rented this place that had I had the money, I probably still wouldn't have bought it because it was this little shack, but it was in the nicest beach in California. Yeah. And the lady said, Peter, you know, I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to sell the house. And I'm thinking, oh, geez. She says, but it's going to cost, I think it was $198,000.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, where do you think I fell off the turnip truck? Give me $198,000. That lot probably would have, now Woods is worth
millions.
Oh, yeah. 30, 40 million.
Yeah, yeah.
It's where David Geffen built his big, and anyhow. Mm-hmm. And the waves are coming in, and I started this little opening sequence, and that song just started to come out, Wishing You Were Here. And so I wrote the song, got up to Colorado, which is a little higher altitude and always takes your range down a bit.
Mm.
It's higher altitude. And I realized that I had written it in a key I could play it in, but I couldn't really belt it. You know, the opening lines of the song were too low. And so I had Terry sing the opening, and then I sang the bridge. And the Beach Boys were coming up to record right after we were going to finish in about 2 days. And, you know, who didn't, you know, I wanted to be a Beatle or a Beach Boy.
Yeah.
That's it.
Same here.
Two things. Yeah. Beatle, yeah. Beach Boy. Probably Beatle more than Beach Boy.
Yeah.
I'm sort of an Anglophile. When it comes to music, I'm Anglophile. And
by the way, I did have one chance meeting with Paul McCartney. It was unbelievable.
Oh, great for you.
Yeah. But keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so they came and I talked to Carl Wilson and, hey, would you guys be interested? Yeah. So they came in, played them the song. We worked up parts. And so for one night, I was a Beach Boy. I sang with Carl Wilson, Dennis Wilson, who was quite a good singer.
The drummer?
Yeah, the drummer.
Yep.
Al Jardine
and
myself. I don't think Mike Love was. We sang the harmonies, and there you go.
Yeah.
Magical. And you know, people ask about magical. We were playing Angel Stadium years ago, outdoors, on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
We did a tour with the Beach Boys, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the show, we'd all come back. They would sing one of our songs, and I sang one of theirs.
Yeah.
I sang Darlin'. Dip, 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 darlin'. Right?
Yeah.
And anyhow, as we come off the stage, and the crowd's going, and we're all ready to go back on it, you know, Carl goes, hey, Ringo's here, man. There's Ringo Starr right back.
Oh, is that right?
Wow. And I'm flabbergasted.
Yeah.
You know? So, do you want to come up and we're going to do Got You Get Into My Life? We did that. I just sang that. Oh, sure, I'll come up. And so he grabs a tambourine. And if you'd have seen the Angel Stadium, I said, ladies and gentlemen, Ringo Starr. So Beach Boys, Chicago, Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
And the upper deck is bouncing, literally bouncing. Wow. We thought it was going to collapse. Anyhow, magical moment in my life.
That's a great moment. It's interesting to hear super accomplished artists like yourself. And I've heard a number of them that they point to Pet Sounds from the Beach Boys as one of the most brilliant pieces of work of all time.
Well, you're going to meet one that doesn't. I don't point to that at all. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well,
it's okay.
Well, yeah, it's okay. Yeah. So it's just an opinion. Yeah. But let's say you're right or you're wrong. It doesn't matter. But what you're really saying, and you said before, is that the brilliance of their harmonies, of the way they all come together.
The best.
Right?
Well, Beach Boys and the Beatles. The Beatles had some. I would say I'm more the in my room, Don't Worry Baby.
Yeah.
Those are my Beach Boy.
Yeah.
Those songs are just God Only Knows.
That is my favorite Beach Boy song of all time. God Only Knows.
Well, that's Carl Wilson singing
it's
lead.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Carl and I became really good friends.
Yeah.
And we started a band. We were going to start a band together.
Wow.
Carl Wilson, myself, Ricky Fattar, who was the drummer for the Beach Boys after Dennis
quit drowned.
Or whatever, or got drowned.
Yep.
And we even wrote a song, which I put on my first solo record, which never went anywhere because the record company did not want me leaving the group, right?
That's when you were with Warner.
So they actually torpedoed my solo album, which was quite good.
Yeah. Wow. Anyhow,
yeah.
So let me ask you this. So still going down the same thread. So you have this brilliant song called The Glory of Love, which is around the Karate Kid movie, right?
Well, that's another fake news.
Well, here's what I'm trying to ask you. Let me ask you first, and sure. then you can bend it around. Is when somebody goes, because I think you've been involved in a couple film projects, Summer Lovers, right? And so
yeah, that's another. Yeah.
Okay. So where I'm going though is that when somebody is going to use a song and put it as part of a soundtrack to a movie, is that something that you're sitting there in a essentially a silent theater with no sound, and you're watching a movie and you're inspired? Where somebody comes to you and says, hey, we're at this movie and this is what it's about. And then you're inspired to write something that you think it relates to.
Well, it used to be that way. It used to be, and I think Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney ruined it, or Michael Jackson, or whoever had that song, Black and White or whatever. One of those people had a song that won an Academy Award, but they found out that it was recorded before the movie. So it couldn't have been written for the movie. So I'll tell you a tantalizing fact.
Yeah.
So David Foster and I go in, like we always did, and sit by the piano, and I sort of talk through his, no, wait. Oh, that's great. What is that? You know?
Yeah.
And then we put down a track, and I take it home and keep singing a melody and the words till I come up with. And in the case of Glory of Love, my then manager got a call from Rocky people. Hey, we're looking for a song for Rocky, the one where he fights the Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do it? And I went, hell yeah. So in the case of that one, they sent me a tape, not of the whole movie, just eight whatever VHS tape and a script. And I sat there and just watched it for a couple of things. And let's see, fighting, you know. And I had this chord track, and I started singing, and we did it all. And, the glory of love. Hey, wait a minute. What if it's about like knights and shining? And I just
the knights and shining.
I just came along that thing. We took it, and I finished it, and I thought it's the first and only song I ever thought. Well, no, it was the first one I thought that's a hit. It's got to be a hit. They got to love this. We took it back, and they turned it down. Stallone turned it down. I to this day, I have no idea. Maybe he...
And it was a hit.
Maybe he wanted his brother Frank to sing it. I don't know. So here we have this wonderful song that I wrote for Rocky, just got turned down. A week later, two people, music people, call up David. And David said, hey, these people are coming in today. They're looking for a song for Karate Kid. I said, great. So they come in. We play them the song. And they're like flabbergasted because I'm a man who fight for your honor. Wow. It works in that music. You know what I mean? It works for
Karate
Kid. It was
fantastic. Yeah.
And so, and this is where the sneaky part comes in. Right at that very, the year before, right, they had a thing where the Academy Award passed a thing where you have to write explicitly for the movie. So this guy said, all right, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll guarantee you a number one song. We will work our tails off to push it there. We're going to get Academy Award with this one. I know it. But you can never say that you wrote the song before the movie.
Mm.
What? No. You say that you wrote it deal. So I made a deal with the devil. Yeah. Right? So all through that year, the song goes to number one. It gets Academy Award nomination.
Yeah.
I go to singing on stage.
Yeah.
People ask, what are your nervous two moments in your life? Singing at the Academy Awards. Singing the Star Spangled Banner at the World Series.
Really?
The one where Kirk Gibson hit that home run. Anyhow, so for the whole year, I had a lie. Everybody, was this written expressly for the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It just ruined the whole, you know? And in the end, we didn't win, but it's still a great song.
Hey, this pod is sponsored by Laird Superfoods. So many products to choose from your Instafuel, your coffee, your tea, your smoothies, And I love the superfood creamer and use the hydration powders like the beets, the coconut, the matcha, the turmeric to mix all into my 7 Summit smoothie. And it's so good. Log on to LairdSuperfood.com and get your 20% off when you use the code MarkP20. Okay? So get your Laird Superfood, and I guarantee it will help fuel your journey. Well, it's a great song, and to me, all that stuff doesn't matter.
No.
Whether you made it for the movie or you didn't, it was a phenomenal song, and the song stands the test of time, probably even more so than the actual movie, you know, in my opinion.
Without a doubt. The movie was horrible.
Yeah, you know, so, it was one of those things. So you have this brilliant career with Chicago, and that lasted a heck of a long time, mm-hmm. and you had a lot of highs, and I'm sure there was lows in there, and especially when the disco era was really starting mm-hmm. to hit, right? I'm sure you saw some kind of decline in terms of your sales and popularity that you had prior to that.
Yeah, and that was, really, you know, the big thing about the whole group was drinking and drugs. I mean, that was the big downfall.
Yeah.
Let's state that clearly.
Yeah, and you're not
big
alone.
Downfall.
Yeah.
And we all did it to some aspect of, and some of us got burnt out more than the others, and some of us quit, and that was the downfall of it, because nobody around you ever said, "Hey, man, could you knock off doing that blow?" You know,
yeah.
Nobody ever said that.
Enablers, right?
Yeah, in a quiet way.
Yeah,
and that was the start of the downfall. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to clean my act up because I want to get out of here, and I'm not going to leave. You know, be like a rat on a sinking ship. So I cleaned my act up, and we got together with David Foster. And that's how we started that string of David Foster and Peter Cetera songs.
But before that, didn't David come in to and produce songs that you and David got together? You wrote songs for Chicago, which became that monster 1984 mm-hmm. year, right?
Right.
And then it was after that that you wanted to do solo records like some of the other band members were doing. And right. they weren't grooving on that. And
no, they were always, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, David, when David came in, and he was a big fan of the group, and I hadn't written anything at that point, because I was totally frustrated with the whole scene.
Yeah.
And I just had a baby and blah, blah, blah. And he came in and he said, "Well, show me what you got." And everybody played him their songs, and they were shit. They were just pure shit. And I didn't say anything, and he called me over later. He says, "Don't you have any songs?" I went, "No." I says, "I don't even want to be here, you know." He goes, "Yeah, songs are crap, you know." So that's when he and I, you and I, and that's when we got together and created a big thing because we used other players on the album, and then we had a string of hits, you know, a couple albums in a row. Then I just said, "Hey, you know, I just want to do solo album with stuff that I can't do here," and created a big stink, you know.
Well, I mean, based on what I heard, and these are my words now, is that the Chicago always wanted to remain kind of a nameless band. They just wanted to have a bunch of musicians that were coming together. And just like all things, you kind of emerged as that star, really the key voice. And so I'm sure there was some rub there.
If one were to watch that crackumentary that I call it.
Yeah.
Like I said, the drugs were the big, big deciding factor because nobody could write. Nobody. They were crap. You name me one song that happened after that time with me and Foster that they wrote. They just didn't. It's just, and I wanted out. And it's funny how that works. We were always looked upon as these clean cut.
You sure were.
But the fact of the matter is that cops loved us. Guys in the service loved us because we looked like we were these hardened South Side of Chicago. We were doing as much as anybody else, you know. But it just became, you know, I don't like the way you're squeezing the toothpaste. You know, that was, you know, what you hear about a marriage or something.
Yeah.
And, they wanted me to go. I said, "All right, I'll do one more album and then I'll do my solo album," right? Yeah. The lawyer, "Sure, yeah, they'll let you." So I did one more album, went on the road for one more hard-ass year, felt it was time to do my solo album. And I said, "I'm doing my solo album." No, you have to. "We got to get back in the studio." No, "I'm doing my solo album." "No, you can't." And so one day, there's knock at the door, and I lived in Malibu, up in the hills. I mean, it. Yeah. And there's a guy there, and he hands me a letter. Thank you. And he walks away. I open the letter, and it's basically from the manager and the business manager and the group. Unless you sign this paper saying that you'll perform, next year, we're going to have to look for somebody else. And I was just, my then wife started crying, and I'm like, going, what? Out of a job? Oh my God! You know, I mean, really. And I thought about it.
That's about an hour. Well, that's really interesting. You're thinking about it that way in terms of out of a job, because you, and especially in 1984, I was sitting in Key Arena in Seattle watching you and your group up there play these amazing songs that you guys had come up with. And also from the past, and had a great experience. And, you know, it's just like you were well on your way, you were well established, and, you know, people knew who you were individually outside of the group.
Right.
So it seems like it would be weird that you would be, from an outsider's perspective, that you'd have this angst about, you know, what does the future look like now?
Well, when you're never told that, when all the managers and the business accountants and the record people don't want you to leave. They're not going to tell you how great you are. They're not going to tell you how important you are, you know. So, yeah, it was always kind of a sour feeling, you know. It was just like, you know, I just wanted out. But, you know, it took me to this day. I still don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up, you know. I mean, that's really, seriously, it's like it was shaky ground, you know.
Yeah.
Because I'm up from the hardworking south side of Chicago where, you know, you had to work, you had to have a job. And I had no illusions about, am I great? No, I didn't. I was on the other side of that.
You're
you
doing
know?
Your thing.
I was timid. And it was all.
So let me ask you this about Foster. So this is David Foster we're talking about, and you guys going to have this amazing partnership.
You're ruining my book I'm going to write, all these questions.
We can collaborate. With John Foster, what does he bring? I know he's this brilliant guy, and he's worked with all these brilliant people. What does he bring to the table?
Well, somebody like him, first of all, there was only two people I ever worked with that had unbelievable piano chops, and he was, I would say, number one, and maybe Michael Omardian, number two. And they would play things that I could never think of, and I'd go, wait, what was that chord progression, you know? So,
yeah.
He brought that. He brought a musical sense. He tried to bring back a little oomph to the group. And this whole jazz thing was a big, I mean, nobody in this group was a jazz player. And that flopped. Everybody wanted to do a jazz album but me. And I was just, you guys are crazy. We're not going to play the hits at concerts anymore. We're going to play what we want to play. So one night it lasted. And I said, no, we got to go back to the hits, boys.
Yeah.
But Foster, he brought positiveness, he brought musicianship, and he just went, no, those songs stink, you know, or not. So he brought, and he was magical to work with. I love working with the guy, you know. He was, and we had a good string of things, and then he went on and got bigger and better things. And personally, I think he did another Chicago album, but he got, you know, he got tired of no music coming out of those guys, and he got tired of the hassle that was what the group was at that point.
He seems like he is, unless you bring it in full professionalism, he's got no time for you.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Right?
Yeah, he can be, you know, he's Canadian. He's white bread. If you ever talk about what a Canadian, you know, you laugh about. You know,
A?
C, A, D, A. Yeah. He was it. White bread, didn't drink, flew his own plane, had his own boat, smart as a whip, musically, nobody like him. And it's a proven track record, the people he's worked with. He's a fantastic. And, you know, he had a little problem sometimes of saying the wrong thing. All, you know, I mean, he had this sarcastic wit that wasn't always funny.
Mm-hmm.
And the less you knew him, the less funny it was. So, but deep down, he's really a good guy.
There's a medley that I saw that it's on YouTube, and it goes for 8 or 9 minutes, and it's David Foster. He's on stage. He's got this beautiful orchestra in the background, and then you come out and sing 4 or 5 of your songs, right? They chop them up.
Yeah.
The thing that was magical though about me, beyond you know you and your voice in the string section, and the way that I assume it was David that put all those pieces together to make the music.
Well, David and I,
yeah. Yeah. So, but the thing that really stood out to me is that you had your daughter as a background singer.
Yeah.
I mean,
let's see, what show was
it? Well, you were in Chicago.
I think that was the McDonald's. No, I couldn't have been in Chicago when that happened.
I thought you were in Chicago.
No, I think that was after. I think that was the McDonald's when he first, I don't know what show that is.
Well, your daughter was in so where I'm trying to go is, like, I have two daughters, right? They're 21, 23 now. And it's just, I'm so proud when I get to be involved with them and doing different things.
Yeah.
And so to have your daughter be a background singer to these iconic, great, amazing songs that you and Foster put together,
yeah,
you know, was just magic.
Well, my daughters are now 36 and 22. Mm-hmm. And I've had them one time, both on stage at the same time. My oldest daughter, Claire, was actually my singer for a couple of gigs. She was the one I sang the duets with, and when I went out on solo and with the orchestra, I'd bring her out, we'd sing the duets, and she'd leave. And at a certain point, she said, "Dad, it's kind of weird singing a love song with your dad." You know, and she's right. But she's on my Christmas album, and then my youngest daughter got up on stage one night. She's really shy. And, of course, now she's a big dancer and, you know. No, but Foster's, he was fun to work with. And I've always tried to get him back in the studio, but he doesn't have enough time for me. No, he's a great guy.
So you've been able to partner with a lot of people. Paul Anka, Madonna, Billy Joel, the Beach Boys, we talked about that before, Bonnie Raitt, Karen Carpenter. What a voice.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like all these brilliant artists like yourself that you've, is there one, and I'm not looking for like who's my favorite, but that like when like their talent like even blew you away?
Well, I mean, you know, what's funny is that when everybody, I work Chaka Khan, I work with Madonna, you know what I mean? And Agnetha Fältskog, who is one of ABBA. When everybody gets behind that mic, they're all of a sudden they turn into a real person. Yeah. They don't have that, look at me, mofo. You know, no. That goes all the way. They're just as nervous as I am, and they get over it. What was shocking to me was Madonna was the most fun.
Really?
Yeah, she was great.
What's she like?
She pulled up in her own car, came in, laughed, talked, joked, learned a part, sang. It was great.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think she's brilliant. I mean, I saw her back in the day too, probably the same year I saw Chicago when they came through Seattle. Mm-hmm. I went to her first show of all time. I don't know if you ever played the Paramount, the old Paramount
Theater
out there. Yeah, of
course, a couple of times.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a Seattle guy. Yeah, so I saw her play the first concert she ever played in her life when she was still had that lace and all that stuff going on.
She was professional. That was fun. It was good.
What song did you sing with her?
Well, I did a song on my album called Scheherazade, mm-hmm. and it's on one of my solo albums. And I was so I didn't want to act like I was Mr. Big Time Madonna singing background.
Yeah.
So, like a fool, I changed her name to her road name, which is Lulu Smith.
Okay.
She used to use that on the road, and, you know, somebody would call up, "Can I have Madonna's fire one, please?" Who? You know, but, you know, Lulu Smith, they knew who that was. So, a lot of fun.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, it's funny. We're sitting here talking music.
Yeah.
And my connection is sports with you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This guy comes into our 25-year-old basketball old-timers games. And I don't know who you are.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I ended up being the hammer all these years.
Yeah.
I was the guy that had to go up to the guy and say, "Who are you?"
Yeah.
So I did. "Who are you? I'm Jim, man." And all of a sudden, here comes this guy 20 years younger than the oldest, 20 years younger than the youngest guy, and he's good.
Yeah.
And,
You know, it was interesting because flipping that story around a little bit, I knew that Jim Kirkkonen, right, who's a good guy, he sold me this place we're sitting in right now here in Ketchumato. And somehow or another, I'd learned that he's always been a big, you know, basketball. That's his passion.
Yeah.
So he says, "You got to come out. We have a bunch of good guys." And I said, "Do I know any of them?" And he goes, "No, but you may know this guy, Peter Cetera." Yeah, of course. And so I go, God, I'd love to do a podcast. And I go, well, Peter's not going to do a podcast on it if you don't come out and play basketball. I go, Jim, I have literally, I hung up, I retired from professional or from basketball 10 years ago. No, so I don't want to have the old guy.
Like, there's a big difference. There's a big difference.
Right. So I came out and I had a great time. I played a couple times. I don't think I've gone back since. It's just, you know, with Everest coming up, I just want to make sure that
well, I
just need to stay, make sure that I'm on the right side of the road with
I
that.
Haven't played in a year. Because of my back and my foot, and but yeah, I'm a sports guy. I love it. I've climbed a couple of, a couple of things. I've climbed the Eye of the Needle up there with Bob Rosso. I've climbed a Jackson Hole.
You've been at Bora, highest mountain in Idaho.
Mount Boring, no.
Mount Boring.
Mount Boring. Everybody calls it. Who goes there?
No, it's not. It's straight up.
That's what I heard. It's straight up, but there's not much of a.
It's something. Yeah. I mean, it's something to
something about the last. Something over the, I don't know.
Yeah.
No.
But we're going to have to get your foot fixed.
The Teton I climbed, that was fun. We climbed a bunch over there and then got the Grand. And so you're probably looking at the person that's read the most about climbing.
Yeah.
That's somebody that's never climbed. I mean, I thought I was going to climb Everest. I really did. Yeah. I thought, God, dog, I want to climb. I mean, I've read every book about climbing and then when I went to the Tetons, Bob Rosso, do you know Bob?
Owns
the Elephant's Perch.
Okay.
Great guy.
Yeah, yeah.
A hammer. He's a hammer. And he was training, so he had these enormous boots on. And we're up in the Tetons, and he didn't need them, but they were going to climb, I don't know, Annapurna. I don't remember what the name of the mountain was. And he didn't make it. Mm. He got the, pulmonary edema.
Yeah.
Came down, and I thought, if that guy, who's as strong as an ox,
I've seen it little by little,
I know Martin Adams, who was on that fateful trip with, what are the guys' names? Hall and...
Rob Hall, yeah.
Yeah, Martin Adams climbed with Bukharev.
Yeah, the Russian.
The first one up. They were the first ones up on the first day. They went up, it was clear.
Wow.
They came down, the next day that party started.
Yeah.
So to hear his tales, it's
I had Ed Viesters on, and
Ed's a great guy.
Yeah, Ed's a great guy, and he was telling about that story, and he actually was one of those guys also that was going down, and they just didn't feel it that day. He was with another guy named David Brashears, and they were shooting this IMAX film, Everest, and so they were going up, and they're like, just didn't feel right, and they didn't have as sophisticated weather forecasting
as
in those days, and then the disaster, and then it was just. It was a very heartfelt moment when Ed was describing what it was like. Because after the whole mountain cleared, it was sunny. And they was like, miles will go. And they went up and they had to step over Rob Hall and the other Scott Fisher.
Well,
that was tough.
This Martin Adams also climbed Alaska. I don't know who he climbed it with.
Denali?
Yeah, he climbed Denali. I don't remember who. Same thing happened. He went up the first day.
Yeah.
Beautiful sunny day. Zip, zip. Next day, boom, it's a whiteout.
Yeah.
So he was lucky on two things. Anyhow, that is past. I've read more about mountain climbing, and it's out of my system now.
Well, one of the things that would be fun, it'll be fun for me. I don't know if it'd be fun for you, but when I'm climbing, I'm going to have a Garmin tracker. So you're going to be able to actually see me, going up the mountain on that day.
You're going to wear your Raiders helmet?
I am. Go Raiders.
Raiders.
So for you, is there what does it look like for Hugh? I mean, I when I said this to you in the Java, this is the coffee shop up the street, and I just said, what a gift. And so that's me looking at you, not necessarily you looking out to the world, right? Because it's you, and you've always done this, right? Yeah. So it's not a big deal. But where does it go from here in terms of your musical career?
I really don't know. I always thought about, what am I going to do when I retire? Yeah. When will I know? And then I started thinking, I'm going to quit before I lose my voice, because I've seen too many people out there. I was like, man, give it up. So I really worked hard solo-wise the past couple of years up until last Thanksgiving. I wanted to see what was left out there for me, and I worked my tail off, and I actually blew my brains out. I mean, I came home last Thanksgiving. My last gig was up here, and I went, I'm done. What? How can you be done? Yeah. Just too much travel.
What happens if we have Peter Cetera show here in Sun Valley, and that's it.
No, you once never want to work at your home. I worked one time here at the theater, and I played one show at the outdoor thing with the with a Mormon symphony. Nah, I'm done. Yeah. I just don't. Do I miss it? No, I don't really miss it because the travel got when you're on top and you're flying private, you know, and hey. But then when it all comes back down to earth and you got to fly, you have to get up at 5 in the morning to catch a 6:30 flight, 3 flights across here to get to the, you know, middle of some casino somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Then you got to get up the next morning. Nah, too much. Enough. So now I have to learn how to be a out-of-work singer.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you've got something up your sleeve. So last question for you. Yeah. And I was thinking more about this. You know, you were coming over and I was trying to, you know, I've done all this research and everything. And the one thing that just kept coming back is, well, actually, there's two questions. Is one is, what do you think about all these voice shows like The Voice or American Idol?
I don't even watch them. I think it's just bogus. Yeah. I don't know. In the beginning, I thought it was, hey, American Idol, how cute. Yeah. No, it's just I don't find enjoyment in it. I got to tell you, TV now, I don't watch. I watch sports and documentaries and you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Cause that's why I watch.
Yeah. I don't watch those shows. It's just so phony. And really, when you look back to all these shows, tell me who stuck.
Well, making that comment the other night about The Voice. I go, I don't think I can think of any one person who's ever made it.
Carrie Underwood.
Well, she's made it, and Kelly Clarkson.
Kelly Clarkson.
That's probably it.
What's the other girl? Anyhow.
Not many.
Yeah. So it's all music. That's like music today. It's all disposable.
Yeah.
Instantaneously disposable. Name me one group that's like new and... A group. There's no groups anymore, right? Would they play and sing?
Certainly not like in the old days.
No, I mean, now it's like, everybody thinks that they can be on American Idol or The Voice and become stars, you know? Just like everybody wants to be a quarterback. Everybody wants to be, point guard. Everybody, you know? But the truth of the matter is that you end up a garbage man.
Well, sometimes you do. And I think at the end of the day, to me, it goes back to the very thing that you said at the very opening of this. And what I had to go through is that if you truly have your eye on the ball, it's not about the stardom and all the press and all that kind of stuff. It's about loving that process and getting in the car and, like you said, driving all over Canada and back and California and getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning and pulling a trailer behind your VW. You know, it's a lot of work and it's more uncomfortable than it is comfortable. And that's what sustains you through time.
You bet. It's the love of what you're doing. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
You don't. And I think now that's not there anymore. I want to be a star. I want to be a star. All right. And I know it sounds like old, kind of when I was young, my mom, oh, Frank Sinatra's so good. And I'm going, what?
Yeah.
But when she saw the Beatles on TV, the first time they were on TV, she had the smile on her face. And, she could tell talent. And she had that same smile whenever I'd sing.
Well,
so
that's obvious. So last question is, you could be anywhere you want. Your former band and yourself, you've sold 100 million plus albums. I mean, it's insane. Why Ketchum? Why Sun Valley?
Well, you know, that's funny that you, in a way we were talking about a bucket list and you're living your bucket list right now. You're going to go, I don't have a bucket list. I can't think of one thing that I go, doggone it. I wish I would have done that. Yeah. I can't. I mean, years ago when my first daughter was born, we were living in Malibu after moving from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I was, we were looking for a place to go skiing. And we were driving all around and with a little camper came up, we were going past the exit down there on the interstate for Sun Valley. And that interstate, that intersection down there, it looks like what?
Yeah.
Let's keep driving, honey.
Yeah.
Step on the gas. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's all like
not
lava
a whole
rock.
Lot there. Yeah.
But we made a turn and came up here and we ended up camping right up north and went, it was maybe the end, middle of October.
Yeah.
And let's come back here. So we booked a place over in Warm Springs to come back the following Christmas and just fell in love with the
magical.
There's something smooth about the mountains here.
Yeah.
They're not so intimidatingly steep, and they're just kind of smooth. And whenever I would land, coming into the valley, I'd go, ah.
Yeah.
You know, and whenever I take off, I would go, yeah, it's good to get out of town, you know. Great people. And what I should be saying is it's the worst up here. Don't ever come up here ever again because, no, there's a lot of great people up here. And, you know, they let me in the club. You know, I learned how to ride bikes in the groups and, you know, they'd always pull me along, you know.
Yeah.
And mountain climbing and snowboarding and, you know, so it's just a great place. And I don't know where I would go. I think I would just stay here, you know, find another place. And, I love it here.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I moved here a year and a half ago, but I started coming over here back in the day when I was 19 years old at the University of Washington and for spring break because, one, the drinking age was 19, and two, I would go crazy on the mountain during the day and at night, you know, in the bars. And then when after this week, I came back and it was spring ball. And through with my hardcore head coach, Don James. And, and so, you know, I'd been up at, you know, 10,000 feet and skiing and just grinding the legs as a receiver. I came in every single time in great shape.
Right.
Yeah, it was fantastic. So
that's good.
Yeah. So, you know, when I moved from Hermosa Beach, which Manhattan Beach, which, you know, I moved here a year and a half ago. It was just like, as I was getting more hardcore into these mountains, it was just like, I'm going for full commitment. And that full commitment was being here, being able to climb, living at 6,000 feet, going up and down that mountain every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really helped transform my conditioning and preparedness for these different, you know, huge mountains that I've been taking on.
Did you ever do the climb up on your skins?
Every day.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That's like, do I brush my teeth?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good little charge up that hill.
Yeah.
Good little wake-up call.
Hey, listen. This is it. This has been a joy.
Thank you, man. No, seriously.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. A way that I can get to know you on a deeper level. Number one, number two, you're a good guy. Number three, you've got a you know, God blessed you with this talent, and I'm so happy that you were able to, you know, brighten my life in other moments when I didn't know you years ago, and that legacy continues to go. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, man. Good talking.
All right, buddy. Thanks. Hey, thank you so much for dropping in and listening to another amazing episode of Finding Your Summit. Truly incredible people doing spectacular things in life, and I hope you were inspired just like I continue to be. Look, I am super grateful that you came in and subscribed to this pod and would be more than appreciative if you gave the show a ratings and review on iTunes. Trust me, it matters. And then also go share it with your friends, of course. Okay, until next week, go do something great, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion. Bye. Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.